It's time once again for the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Thanks for tuning in. On today's program, we'll be reading an AP News article regarding the effect on students with disabilities that efforts to dismantle the Department of Education may have. We'll hear a piece from the LA Times about a blind opera singer. From the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, we'll hear a piece about research looking at health outcomes for those playing disability sports, and other articles of interest. We'll begin with the latest from the Disability Scoop. First is a piece entitled, PBS to Spotlight Story Behind the ADA, by Sean Heasley, published March 17, 2025. A documentary about the decades-long fight for disability rights, culminating in the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, is set to premiere. The film, Change, Not Charity, The Americans with Disabilities Act, follows the twists and turns of a grassroots movement that pushed Congress to mandate curb cuts, ramps, and much more to allow people with disabilities access to American life. Relying on archival footage and interviews with activists, lawmakers, and other key players, the one-hour film chronicles how the disability rights movement organized and took to the streets to lobby for the ADA in the face of strong opposition. Things came to a head with the Capitol crawl when people with disabilities, including many wheelchair users, dragged themselves up the steps of the U.S. Capitol, leading to the 1990 signing of the ADA. I think the message of this film is that civil rights for people with disabilities are just as important as the right that everyone either has or should have in our society, said the film's director, Jim Lebrecht, who has a disability and who is known for his work on Crip Camp, an Oscar-nominated documentary about the origins of the disability rights movement. There was a coming together of many people, disabled and non-disabled. Legislators from both sides of the aisle came together in a bipartisan fashion, he said, referring to the ADA. I hope that our film will remind our viewers and those in power that preserving the civil and human rights of people with disabilities benefits everyone. Narrated by actor Peter Dinklage, Change Not Charity, The Americans with Disabilities Act will air on PBS March 25 at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on American Experience. Also from the Disability Scoop, here's a piece entitled, Federal Proposal Could Threaten Paratransit Partnerships with Uber, Lyft, by Shauna Muckle, Tampa Bay Times, published March 18, 2025. Tampa, Florida. None of Andrew Boyson's initial options for commuting from his home in Tarpon Springs to Pinellas Technical College looked pretty. Boyson has a disability that prevents him from driving a car. He could hop on the county's fixed-route bus system, but the ride would require 30 minutes of walking and a bus transfer, lasting 2 hours if everything went seamlessly. He could wake his mom up at 6 a.m. for the 30-minute drive, or he could pay at least $30 each way for an Uber or Lyft. For most car-free Pinellas County residents, other options are scarce. But Boyson's disability, epilepsy, gave him another opportunity, registering for the county's paratransit system, which allows him to hail rides from his home to school or work for just $4.50 each way. The transit agency covers the rest. Before 2016, paratransit, a door-to-door service required by the Americans with Disabilities Act for people who can't use a regular bus route independently, had one limitation. Riders had to hail rides a day in advance, limiting their ability to access spontaneous events or change plans. But Pinellas County was one of the first transit agencies to coordinate with Uber and Lyft on a new program, Mobility on Demand. The Pinellas Suncoast Transit Authority contracts with rideshare companies to service immediate trips that paratransit otherwise wouldn't accommodate. Traditionally, paratransit programs have been next-day services, said Jen Shepard, global head of Uber Transit, which coordinates partnerships with local agencies. Now it's a same-day service. But a proposed rule from the Federal Transit Administration, drafted weeks before President Donald Trump took office, could threaten those partnerships, which have expanded to more than 80 cities, from Chicago to Phoenix. The rule would require rideshare companies to drug test their drivers if they are to partner with transit agencies. For Uber, which relies on more than 7 million gig workers in the United States, requiring drug tests would diminish driver supply and raise prices, Shepard said. Uber wouldn't ask that of its drivers when the company already screens workers for impaired driving and violent offenses yearly, she said. Conceptually, it's a good idea, said Gloria Lepic-Corrigan, a wheelchair user and disability advocate who occasionally uses mobility on demand services in Pinellas. Don't we all wish that every Uber and Lyft driver was not on drugs? But the policy isn't worth it if it pares back paratransit options, Lepic-Corrigan said. Instead, she advises riders who feel unsafe to say no thank you and request a different driver. Rideshare companies have safety records that mimic or are better than those of traditional paratransit services, Pinellas Suncoast Transit Authority CEO Brad Miller said. In 2023, more than 3 million Uber trips were booked via transit agency partnerships, averaging more than 8,000 rides per day, according to the company. In August, more than 16,000 riders with disabilities in Pinellas scheduled paratransit services through rideshare companies. Without Uber as a paratransit option, I would basically have to schedule my life 24 to 72 hours in advance, Boyson said. If something pops up or I have to cancel it, there's nothing I could do. Pinellas's transit agency wants the partnership to stay in place as well. Contracting with rideshare companies is less expensive than manning a traditional paratransit van, Miller said. If the partnership is canceled, the transit agency estimates it would have to spend at least $1 million more on paratransit services. When the rideshare partnership was implemented, customers, especially people with disabilities, loved the increased mobility that Uber and Lyft offered them, Miller wrote in a letter to the federal government opposing the rule. Now, customers were choosing to ride to lunch with a friend, or the movies, or to a baseball game. Hillsborough Area Regional Transit Authority does not currently contract with rideshare companies, but a conservative board member, Commissioner Josh Wastel, suggested last year that the bus service should offer more subsidized rideshare services. The Pinellas Transit Authority also contracts with rideshare companies to provide late-night rides for workers whose jobs begin or end between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. for $3 each way. The Tampa Bay Times reported in 2017 that Tampa Bay's bus services already connect workers to fewer jobs than most metro areas of a similar size in the U.S., making point-to-point services a critical lifeline. The federal government ended public comment on its proposed rule in mid-February. It's not clear when the rule may advance. Some members of Pinellas's transit agency board have suggested the new administration may dismiss the proposed rule. But until the rule's fate is clear, Uber and transit agencies around the country are rallying to preserve these partnerships that plug gaps in service, Shepard said. Also from the Disability Scoop, we have this piece entitled, "With Help of Therapy Dogs, Schools See Behavioral Problems Ease," by Melanie Burney, the Philadelphia Inquirer. Published March 18, 2025. Philadelphia. As middle school language arts teacher Shana Caputo moved around her social studies classroom, she gently pulled a leash to guide the regular four-legged visitor, a greater Swiss mountain dog, Skye. Caputo is among nearly three dozen staffers certified to handle Skye and his partner, Hope, therapy dogs who work in the Absecon Public Schools. The Swissies provide a calming presence for students who are feeling distressed or a friendly ear for struggling readers reluctant to read aloud. The dogs are popular members of the teaching staff at H. Ashton Marsh Elementary and Emma C. Addles Middle, where they have a full schedule 3 days a week, visiting classes, small group lessons, and counseling sessions. It's a nice change, especially for the middle school students, said Caputo. A lot of the students look forward to seeing the dogs. During a recent morning lesson on ancient Rome, Caputo moved around the special education classroom with Skye in tow. The dog occasionally took a break, plopping down on the floor. He curiously sniffed a cabinet where Caputo stores snacks for students, but no treats for the dogs while working. In the elementary wing for another assignment, Skye sat on the carpeted floor in Lisa Maletta's classroom where a small group of first graders were matching words with phonics cards. When a card was missing, she turned to the culprit, Skye. "Sir, are you hiding the card?" she asked jokingly, pulling the card from beneath the 140-pound dog. Maletta said her students are more focused and pay better attention when the therapy animals are in the classroom. A certified handler, she escorted Hope through the halls to her next class assignment. "I love having that as an option. It's a great way to help the kids feel confident and comfortable," said Maletta. "We took a chance on it." Superintendent Daniel Dooley initially started the pet therapy program with Skye a decade ago as a teacher in the Commercial Township School District in Cumberland County after researching the benefits of pet therapy. He wanted a free program to try a different approach to reach students with disabilities, who comprised nearly one-third of the enrollment. "People thought we were crazy," Dooley recalled. "We took a chance on it." Dooley got the idea to use pets for therapy after his father was in a rehabilitation facility in 2005 and desperately missed his English bulldog. After getting the dog certified as a service dog, Dooley took him for a visit. Not only was his dad happy, but other patients clamored for time with the bulldog. Dooley wondered if that would have a similar impact on students. Dooley obtained Skye from Kismet Swissies, a breeder in Birdsboro, Pennsylvania, who donated the dog to the district on the condition that Skye be permitted to show. Dooley and his wife Stephanie agreed, not fully understanding the commitment. Skye was a big hit in Commercial Township, socializing freely with students, cuddling, and patiently listening to them read aloud. The Swissie was a perfect match, friendly and confident, but never aggressive, Dooley said. He was certified as a therapy dog by Forever as Friends. In 2018, Skye made headlines when he competed in the Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show in New York for the second year in a row. He didn't place in the best of his breed, but had a great appearance at the most exclusive dog show in the country. These days, Skye has a more laid-back lifestyle in Absecon, where Dooley has been school chief since 2019. Dooley added a second therapy dog, Esperanza, who everyone calls Hope. They interact with about 150 to 300 kids weekly, he said. Sitting next to teacher Jordan Glick as she read Good Boy Fergus, a story about a curious dog, to students in the SMILE, Silent Mentors in Literacy Education program, Hope was quiet as classical music played. Anthony Fideli, 6, reached out to gently pet the dog. When Hope got a little fidgety, one girl suggested, "We can read to her." He has a great sense of their feelings. Dooley said the impact has been astounding and has helped the school address students' social, emotional, and mental health needs. First grade reading scores have improved and behavior problems have decreased, he said. Working with the dogs promotes good behavior because students can earn points to spend time with them. The dogs also bring a calming presence to students with disabilities prone to behavioral problems, Dooley said. A student sent to a reset room with one of the dogs during a crisis typically settles down within minutes and can return to the classroom, compared to an average of 17 minutes without a dog, he said. Unconditional love from Sky in a tough counseling session can get a child to open up about a sensitive subject, said Mary Alvarado, an elementary school counselor. A gentle nudge from the dog breaks down barriers, she said. Then the tears will come, she said. He has a great sense of their feelings. Known as the dog guy, Dooley has become a pet therapy enthusiast and expert. His program has become a model for educators across the country, and he mentors about 100 schools with similar programs. He testified earlier this year at a State Assembly Education Committee on a bill that would create a 3-year pilot program to assess the academic, social, and emotional benefit of animal therapy to students. Programs initially would be set up in 2 districts in each of the state's north, central, and southern regions and could expand statewide. Experts say animal therapy can improve student achievement and boost self-esteem and confidence. It also promotes character traits such as patience, nurturing, caring, and empathy. Sometimes they need to see a counselor. Sometimes they need to see a therapy dog, said Michelle Pitch, assistant director of the Schreiber Family Pet Therapy Program at Rowan University, which has 30 therapy dogs. In Absecon, parents may opt out of the program for children with pet allergies or fears of dogs. If a student opts out, the dog is kept in a separate area. The dogs are kept on a leash at all times. When they're not working, the dogs live with Dooley, his wife, and 2-year-old son. They ride to work with him and are returned to his office at the end of the day. Dooley maintains a distance from the dogs during school hours to avoid distracting them. Dooley believes the program has benefited his students. Anything to make a child's day brighter. Next up from the Los Angeles Times, blind opera singer to perform at Vision Beyond Sight Gala by Sarah Mosqueda, published March 13, 2025. Southern California native Lori Rubin was diagnosed with Leber congenital amaurosis when she was 3 months old. The genetic eye condition is rare, affecting 1 in 40,000 newborns and causing severe vision loss or blindness. The retinas never fully develop, so I can see light, I can see dark, and that's about it, Rubin said. Her family made sure she didn't feel different at home while she was growing up, but in the outside world, she constantly felt pressure to prove herself. It took a toll on my self-esteem for a long time, she said. I felt like a normal kid, but everything that I was hearing outside was different. There were always doors I had to pry open. In spite of the challenges, the mezzo-soprano graduated from the Oberlin Conservatory of Music and the Yale School of Music. She felt her vision impairment didn't define her, but it was difficult to get others to view her the way she viewed herself. Her experience inspired her to write a book titled, Do You Dream in Color? Insights from a Girl Without Sight. Chronicling her journey toward identity, the memoir traces her life from being an isolated adolescent to blossoming into an international opera singer. Rubin now makes her home in Hawaii, where she runs Ohana Arts, a nonprofit arts education organization in Honolulu, with her wife, Jenny Terra, who is a composer, pianist and clarinetist. We started our performing arts organization for youth because Jenny and I both had amazing experiences in performing arts programs, said Ruben. We wanted to bring that to Hawaii. On Thursday, March 27, Ruben will bring her inspiring story to Orange County when she performs at Beyond Blindness's 8th annual Vision Beyond Sight Gala. Lori exemplifies Beyond Blindness's core value of optimism, one of seven that guide our mission to empower children with visual impairments and other disabilities to achieve their fullest potential, said Angie Rowe, President and Chief Executive Officer at Beyond Blindness. Based in Santa Ana, Beyond Blindness provides services like early intervention, education, enrichment, and family support to help children of all abilities build fulfilling and rewarding lives. Each year, the nonprofit provides about 500 children and 1,000 family members with resources. Ruben connected with Beyond Blindness through one of its board members and was delighted to hear about the difference they were making for visually impaired youth and their families. Beyond Blindness really has so many of the values of organizations that I believe in, and I was really excited to hear about what they were doing, Ruben said. It's all about building independence and providing resources. Likewise, Beyond Blindness officials felt that Ruben's story was a perfect example of what can be possible for those living with blindness when they have the right support. Her journey is a testament to resilience, determination, and the belief that anything is possible, even in the face of significant challenges, said Rowe. We are honored to have her perform at our gala, inspiring our guests to join us in building bright beginnings for every child and family we serve. The annual Vision Beyond Sight Gala is one of three major fundraising events Beyond Blindness hosts each year, along with its annual family fair and the Fall Golf Classic. Taking place this year at the Mile Square Golf Course in Fountain Valley, the gala will celebrate those who live with visual impairments, with testimonies from Beyond Blindness alumni, a wine pull, an auction, and a special dining in the dark experience. I will be singing a few songs which range from covers of pop songs to classic folk songs. We will be doing some opera pieces as well, said Ruben. Ruben also plans to perform an original song she wrote with Tara, a personal piece called The Girl I Am. It basically tells the story of my feeling like I didn't fit in as a blind person, but then coming at it with this perspective, knowing that things get better, she said. Copies of Ruben's book will be for sale at the gala, where she will sign them. Additionally, she will be donating copies of Do You Dream in Color to Beyond Blindness and hosting a book club over Zoom on March 18 from 7 to 8 p.m. Ruben believes her story can provide hope to anyone feeling like their vision impairment creates a barrier they can't overcome. While Ruben works hard to not let her blindness define her, she knows talking about her experience can be an inspiration. It feels really good if I, in any small way, can help somebody who is going through some of the same stuff I went through, she said. And now, from the University of North Carolina Charlotte's College of Health and Human Services, this article entitled Research Looks at Health Outcomes from Playing Disability Sports, published March 4th, 2025. With all the intense banging, crashing, and grabbing, it's easy to see why wheelchair rugby was originally called murder ball. The full-contact Paralympic sport isn't for the foolhardy. It can leave athletes with concussions, crushed ribs, broken fingers, and more. The Brain Injury Law Center in Hampton, Virginia, solicits clients who've been injured playing wheelchair rugby and dedicates an entire page on its website to the sport. With the chairs making such forceful contact, athletes can experience whiplash, said J.P. Barfield, FACSM, a recognized researcher in the field of disability and parasport. Unlike other sports, it's not the player-to-player contact that causes injuries. It's the jolt of the chair or the falling out of the chair that's problematic. Barfield, who recently interviewed wheelchair rugby athletes for his research project on parasport concussions, serves as professor and chair of the Department of Applied Physiology, Health, and Clinical Sciences within UNC Charlotte's College of Health and Human Services. Barfield's research focuses on health-related and quality-of-life outcomes of sports for athletes with physical impairments. He's published extensively on athletes with cerebral palsy, spinal cord injury, and muscular dystrophy, and studies how acute responses to sport project to chronic functional changes. He's a board member for the International Federation of Adapted Physical Activity, serving as treasurer, and is head of classification for the Fédération Internationale des Powerchair Football Association, FIPFA, which is the international governing body for powerchair football, also known as powerchair soccer. Powerchair soccer is a sanctioned sport of the Paralympic movement and is under review for inclusion in the Summer Paralympic Games. Barfield travels the globe on behalf of FIPFA to classify athletes for competition. The purpose of FIPFA's classification system is to minimize the impact of impairment on the outcome of competition. Therefore, the athletes who succeed in competition do so on the basis of their sporting ability. To achieve this, athletes are evaluated and put into sport classes according to the extent of activity limitation resulting from their impairment. There are 10 eligible impairment types in parasports, including limb deficiency, impaired muscle power, and leg length difference. As part of his research that integrates with his professional service, Barfield works with UNC Charlotte Assistant Professor Yingo Pan, PhD, a biostatistician in the Department of Mathematics and Statistics, to set the grouping criteria for power chair soccer classification, which is part of the requirements of the International Paralympic Committee. Wheelchair athletes participate in study. In early January, Barfield hosted a two-day wheelchair rugby tournament in UNC Charlotte's Belk Gym, which houses the educational spaces, labs, and offices for the Department of Applied Physiology, Health, and Clinical Sciences. The building also offers three multi-purpose hardwood basketball and volleyball courts, two racquetball courts, badminton courts, locker rooms, and a pool. The annual Queen City Collision Wheelchair Rugby Tournament is organized by Atrium Health's Adaptive Sports and Adventures Program, which sponsors the Carolina Crash, Charlotte's only wheelchair rugby team. Five teams, including Charlotte and Raleigh's Sidewinders, participated in the 2025 tournament. The other three teams were from out of state. Barfield hosted the tournament in 2024 and plans to host it in 2026 and beyond. Holding the tournament on campus provides a free and accessible facility for the games, and it gives Barfield direct access to research participants. Over the course of this year's tournament, Barfield and members of his research team surveyed more than 40 athletes for his study on the treatment of concussions in parasport, which is a continuation of prior research where he looked at baseline concussion testing in this population. At the Queen City Classic Wheelchair Basketball Tournament in Rock Hill, South Carolina last November, Barfield and his team interviewed 65 athletes for the study. To be able to assess concussions, you need baseline scores, and there are not a lot of baseline scores on athletes with disabilities. What Barfield did initially was establish baseline concussion test scores on a common instrument. Now, we're looking at how healthcare changes around concussion based on competition setting so that all players can access a good referral, he said. We're looking at what level, grassroots, regional, national, do players feel they have adequate health care to assess and treat head injuries? The goal of the research is to share with national and international organizations where there are gaps in healthcare services for athletes with disabilities who've been affected by concussions. Do we need to find ways to get more athletic trainers at the grassroots level, or is it for national tournaments? It's educating organizations about how to update their healthcare policies and procedures, Barfield said. I need to pause the article at this point to let you know that you are listening to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now, back to the article. Working on the project with Barfield is Shelley Linens, Ph.D., Clinical Associate Professor in the Department of Applied Physiology, Health, and Clinical Sciences, who serves as co-investigator. Linens, a leading ankle instability researcher, is also a certified athletic trainer with research experience in head injury and concussion. Other team members include four doctoral occupational therapy students from Emory and Henry University, Barfield's former institution, and Samantha Webb, a UNC Charlotte undergraduate exercise science student, who's assisting with data collection and participant interviews. Many research projects extend over a number of years, so an issue can be studied in depth. Barfield's projects aren't like that. He studies people in real time at one-off sports events to develop a collection of information to make policy recommendations, for example. A lack of funding for this type of research limits how many scholars are tackling it. It's a small research community, so there are far fewer studies in disability sports than able-bodied sports, but you have the same needs. Athletes want to learn how to get better. They want to learn how to be safe. Adaptive sports on campus. Barfield's advocacy for disability sports extends beyond his research and into his role as faculty member, where he's been working to offer opportunities on campus. I foresee more adaptive sports activities on campus, he said. We're working with University Recreation to identify programming that can be offered to students who use wheelchairs. Barfield's Department of Applied Physiology, Health, and Clinical Services hosts wheelchair basketball practices for sanctioned teams in Belk Gym. The city of Charlotte has three sanctioned teams as well as youth developmental teams. These practices give students the opportunity to practice and work with wheelchair athletes. A lot of our students want to go into some type of healthcare field, so exposure to people with physical impairments is a great training opportunity, Barfield said. During these practice sessions, our students get to see how wheelchair sports work and get to learn more about spinal cord injuries, spina bifida, and other types of physical impairments. Because Charlotte has rehab hospitals and an adaptive sports program, the city has a significant number of people with disabilities who want to be active, but very few places where they can do that. UNC Charlotte is accessible and has the know-how and space to offer opportunities to people in Charlotte with physical disabilities, Barfield said. It's our duty and responsibility to provide services to everyone in our community. The city has a need for it, and the university has a pathway to provide those opportunities. And now, from the Disability Rights Network, a press release entitled, "Dismantling the Department of Education Will Have Devastating Impact on Students with Disabilities," March 14, 2025. Contact David Card, Washington, D.C. This week, the White House made good on its threats to dismantle the U.S. Department of Education, a decision that will upend the educational rights and protections of millions of students nationwide, particularly those with disabilities. This move endangers the progress made under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, IDEA, and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, both of which have been crucial in ensuring equal access to education for students with disabilities. The administration's actions against the Department of Education are an attack on students with disabilities and their families, who rely on federal oversight to ensure they receive the support and services they need, said Marlene Sallow, executive director of the National Disability Rights Network. Without the Department of Education's enforcement of IDEA, students could face discrimination, inadequate accommodations and services, and a rollback of the hard-fought rights that have been in place for decades. The Department of Education plays a crucial role ensuring that schools meet their legal obligations to provide a free and appropriate public education, FAPE, for students with disabilities. With the reduction of employees and the dismantling of several Office of Civil Rights regional offices, families will be forced to navigate a patchwork of state policies, many of which lack the funding and infrastructure to support students with disabilities effectively. Further, the Department of Education directly funds local school districts and teachers, as well as critical research that supports students with disabilities to be productive members of their communities. Local communities will suffer devastating impacts as a result of delaying, reducing, and ending these funds. The potential consequences are dire, continued Sallow. Many states already struggle to meet the needs of students with disabilities, and without federal oversight, we risk widespread violations of students' rights and access to quality education. On that same subject, from the Associated Press, Education Department staff cuts could limit options for families of kids with disabilities, by Annie Ma, published March 15, 2025, Washington. For parents of kids with disabilities, advocating for their child can be complicated, time-consuming, and expensive. Changes at the Education Department are likely to make the process even more difficult, advocates for kids with disabilities say. When a parent believes their child is not receiving proper services or school accommodations for a disability, they can seek remedies from their district. They can file complaints with their state, arguing the child's rights have been taken away without due process of law, or even pursue litigation in state or federal courts. Those processes often involve multiple sessions with hearing officers who are not required to be experts in disability law. Legal fees can cost tens of thousands of dollars for a single case. Legal aid and other advocacy organizations that can provide free assistance often have more demand for their services than they can meet. But filing a complaint with the Education Department has long been an option for families who can't afford a lawyer. They begin by filling out the Office of Civil Rights online form, documenting the alleged instances of discrimination. From there, the agency's staff is supposed to investigate the complaint, often interviewing school district employees and examining district policies for broader possible violations. It's known and has the weight of the federal government behind it, said Dan Stewart, managing attorney for education and employment at the National Disability Rights Network. The process, the complaint portal, as well as the processing manual are all in public, and it does not require or typically involve lawyers. That option seems increasingly out of reach, advocates say. Under President Donald Trump, the Education Department's staff has been cut approximately in half, including in the Office of Civil Rights, whose attorneys are charged with investigating complaints of discrimination against kids with disabilities. The staff has been directed to prioritize anti-Semitism cases. More than 20,000 pending cases, including those related to kids with disabilities, historically the largest share of the office's work, largely sat idle for weeks after Trump took office. A freeze on processing the cases was lifted early this month, but advocates question whether the department can make progress on them with a smaller staff. The reduction in force is simply an evisceration of the Office for Civil Rights' investigatory authority and responsibility, Stewart said. There's no way that I can see that OCR can keep up with the backlog or with the incoming complaints. A federal lawsuit filed Friday challenges the layoffs at the Office of Civil Rights, saying they decimated the office's ability to process and investigate complaints. While the OCR process was not perfect, reducing the office's investigative staff will only worsen the challenges families face when seeking support for their kids, said Nikki Carter, an advocate for kids with disabilities and one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. It makes them feel hopeless and helpless, Carter said. By reducing the number of employees to handle cases, by putting stipulations on certain cases, it only makes it feel intensified. Education Department officials insist the staff reductions will not affect civil rights investigations, and the layoffs were strategic decisions. In her state of Alabama, Carter said families face an uphill battle to finding legal representation. They don't have the money for an attorney, she said, or the representation they're getting is not the representation they feel like will be best for their child. Even if families can afford the high costs, a limited number of attorneys have the expertise to take on disability discrimination cases. Programs that offer free representation often have limited capacity. If the backlog of cases increases at the Federal Office of Civil Rights, families may lose faith in how quickly the department will investigate their complaints, Stewart said. That may drive them to alternate pathways, such as filing state complaints. But state and local agencies haven't always had the capacity or understanding to handle education disability complaints, Stewart said, since those cases so often went to the U.S. Education Department. They might not have the infrastructure or the knowledge or the staffing to take on the influx of cases, Stewart said. In a separate federal lawsuit filed Thursday, Democratic attorneys general argued the staff reductions at the Education Department may embolden school districts to ignore complaints of discrimination or harassment. Students with current complaints will likely see no meaningful resolution, with cases backlogged due to the shortage of employees to resolve them, the lawsuit said. Students facing discrimination, sexual harassment, or sexual assault will lose a critical avenue to report their case. And now from The Hill, here's a piece regarding Social Security disability entitled, "Social Security is About to Become a Big Problem for Trump," by David A. Weaver, published March 12, 2025. Projections indicate that in less than 2 years, there will be a staggering 2.5 million people in Social Security's disability backlog. That figure is higher than the population of 20 U.S. states and territories. Thus, as we look to the midterm elections next year, President Trump will be dealing with a very large group of Americans who aren't receiving timely decisions on their benefit applications. About 70% of the projected backlog at the end of fiscal 2026 will be at the initial level of determination. These determinations are made by state workers under contract with the Social Security Administration. Over the last several years, the average wait time has risen rapidly, with claimants now waiting an average of 240 days for an initial disability decision, up from 111 days in 2018. The disability backlog and long wait times shine a light on the problematic focus of Trump's so-called Department of Government Efficiency. When government breaks down, the main outcome is not waste, fraud, and abuse, but rather people not being able to access benefits they need. the backlog could easily turn out to be well over 2.5 million cases if current levels of government staffing decline, assumed productivity gains among government workers fail to materialize, or the country experiences a recession and displaced workers with health problems turn to Social Security for help. The political pain of a very large backlog will first be felt by mayors and governors, as large numbers of individuals with severe health problems and little money overwhelm state and local resources. Based on studies of approved and denied applicants whose poverty rates without Social Security income range from 45% to 63%, political leaders can expect between 1.1 million and 1.6 million individuals in the backlog to be living in poverty. The large backlog will be a national driver of homelessness, a situation that occurs with some frequency among disability applicants. Governors of both parties will seek to transmit the political pain to the federal level, most likely by demanding that senators do something about events unfolding in the states. Governors will feel especially pressured because state workers under contract with Social Security will become overwhelmed by their workloads. The backlog of 2.5 million individuals will hit some groups hardest. Based on studies of approved and denied applications, 21% to 31% of individuals in the backlog will be African American. It will be politically scandalous for both parties when 525,000 to 775,000 African Americans are waiting for help from their government. Mayors, particularly in large cities, will aggressively question representatives in Congress about dysfunction in the federal government. Other politically sensitive groups affected by a growing backlog will include military veterans. There are 2.6 million veterans in the U.S. labor force who have a service-connected disability. Many of these individuals will apply for Social Security when age or other factors worsen health and employment is no longer possible. Trump will find it difficult to address a growing backlog, however, because his natural allies in the technology sector and in politics are ill-suited to help him. Trump's first instinct may be to look for a technological fix. His executive order creating DOGE stated its purpose was modernizing federal technology and software to maximize governmental efficiency and productivity. In practice, however, DOGE has become focused on personnel policy and cost-cutting rather than bleeding-edge technology. Social Security recently summarized its DOGE-related activities. If members of the public thought the young engineers at DOGE were going to revolutionize technology in the government, they will be disappointed. The Social Security list is basically composed of budget cuts, including two big items: a reduction in the agency's technology budget and a hiring freeze applied to federal employees and state workers who help process disability claims. A hiring freeze, along with DOGE-driven cuts in the technology infrastructure, will leave Trump with few options to deal with a backlog that may well get out of hand. Without a technology option, the president may look for policy solutions. However, his political allies and subordinates are likely to offer proposals that will make the situation worse. A popular idea among some conservative policy advocates is to conduct more disability reviews to drive individuals off the rolls. But the staffers who would conduct such reviews are the ones needed to work the backlog of cases. During his tenure as Commissioner of Social Security, Martin O'Malley employed extraordinary measures to bend the curve and successfully reduce the disability backlog. But with the new environment, the backlog will resume its natural trend toward higher levels. By 2033, actuarial estimates suggest 4.5 million Americans will have a claim pending. If DOGE and policy advocates are not capable of helping, who should President Trump turn to for advice and assistance? Governors. These state leaders, regardless of party, have a more practical orientation than policymakers in Washington, D.C. Further, governors oversee the state workers who make the initial disability determinations for Social Security. The Trump administration in particular could open communications with the National Governors Association. Such discussions could generate practical solutions to reduce the disability backlog and to mitigate its harmful effects. Even if Trump is unwilling to engage governors, members of Congress should. Senators in particular have a natural connection to other state leaders. Even informed discussions with governors will help Congress understand what is happening on the ground regarding the disability backlog and what can be done to head off an impending breakdown in government. This next piece comes from the Disability Scoop. It's entitled, Students with Visual Impairment Learn to Navigate Streets Without Audible Warning Signals, by Robert McCoppin, Chicago Tribune, March 14, 2025, Chicago. On a recent rainy Monday in Chicago's Loop, a group of students with visual impairment made their way along a sidewalk, sweeping their white canes back and forth to feel curbs and planters. They stopped at a corner to listen. A CTA train roared overhead. Cars rushed in front of them. They waited. When they could hear the traffic move parallel to them, the group began venturing through the crosswalk, safely reaching the opposite corner. The suburban students ranged from sixth grade to high school, and their vision varied from pretty good to almost none. Guided by teachers, their crossing was another little victory in a journey to make their way in a world built for sighted people. I would get more worried if I was alone today, said 10th grader McKenna Krabath, who attends Elk Grove High School. This makes me feel like I can navigate on my own if I had to. Every time the kids come to Chicago, they have to confront a hazardous situation. Chicago's lack of audible traffic signals that beep or play announcements to alert people when to cross. After decades with little response to the problem, a lawsuit filed in 2019 tried to raise the alarm. One of the plaintiffs, a blind woman, was hit by a car while trying to cross the street and faced weeks of recovery. Another blind woman, who commutes from LaGrange to work in Chicago, was nearly hit by a bus, saved by another pedestrian who pulled her back just in time. In 2023, a federal judge ruled that Chicago's failure to install such warning devices violated the Americans with Disabilities Act. Yet, nearly 2 years later, there is no court order to fix the problem. As of November, the city listed 85 crossings with accessible pedestrian signals out of more than 2,800 signalized intersections. Disability rights advocates, which is litigating the case on behalf of the American Council of the Blind of Metropolitan Chicago, has called for the city to add the warning signals at all intersections over the next 10 years, supervising attorney Rachel Weisberg said. The Department of Justice also intervened on behalf of more than 100,000 people with low vision in Cook County. The city officials have proposed in court a more limited program to replace up to 70% of the signals over 15 years. In contrast, in a similar case, New York City already had nearly 2,400 warning signals as of 2023 and plans to have 10,000 in 10 years. In an email, the Chicago Department of Transportation said, "The City of Chicago fully recognizes the importance of accessible pedestrian signals, APS, in ensuring an accessible public way. CDOT incorporates APS signals into all new traffic signal installations, roadway reconstruction projects, and signal modernization projects." Despite the current lack of warning signals in Chicago, the suburban students on their recent field trip to the Loop were determined to get where they were going. The 6 students and 5 teachers, including certified orientation and mobility specialists, came from schools in Schaumburg, Elk Grove, Village, and Palatine. The group navigated their way to Second Sense, a downtown nonprofit that provides services to adults with visual impairment. Instructors there told the kids about free services they offer to adults, including assistive technology, mobility training, help with daily living skills, and guide dogs. But guide dogs don't help if the user doesn't know how to get where they're going, community engagement specialist Kathy Austin said. One missed turn, she said, can leave a blind person lost. If you don't have good orientation and mobility skills, she said, all a guide dog will do is get you lost faster. Second Sense tries to provide what each client needs individually, from measuring medication to parenting classes on changing diapers. In one case, a pregnant woman with low vision couldn't see the face of her fetus on a sonogram. Second Sense was able to make a 3D printout of the image so she could feel her baby's features. One important boost for people with poor vision has been the development of smartphone and tablet apps. They can zoom and magnify things like texts, street signs, and maps and read the words aloud. Some, like Be My Eyes, offer live video chats with volunteers to identify or describe objects. Volunteers can even see what the caller is looking at through Ray-Ban Meta glasses. Other apps like VoiceOver offer audio description using artificial intelligence to describe what is happening in a video. VoiceVista announces landmarks and detailed walking directions, and screen readers like JAWS convert text on computer screens to speech. At school districts 211, 214, and 15 in the Palatine and Arlington Heights area, teachers help the students learn daily living skills, from using appliances for cooking and cleaning to grocery shopping and money management. Next on the students' itinerary was a stop at Sterling Food Hall on South Clark Street, where teachers helped students order lunch or use apps to read the wall menus. The biggest thing I've learned on these trips is having confidence in myself, Fremad High School sophomore Hannah Spadale said. I like to show it doesn't prevent me from leading a normal life. We're pretty much able to do the same things as other kids and want the same opportunities. And that will bring our program to a close. Thanks for listening in to the Disability News on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And keep listening to all the great shows here on Sun Sounds.